Patriots has a message for liberals and the mainstream media.
You can't handle the truth.
So, buckle up, snowflakes, because we're about to deliver the politically direct best in conservative commentary, news, and investigative reports. We're telling the truth, and we're not gonna stop. Okay, liberals, back under the bridge with the rest of your fellow trolls, and oh yeah, thanks for listening to Right Side Patriots.
They are special, special people
on RSPRadio1.com.
Welcome to Right Side Patriots on RSPRadio1.com. Craig Andreessen from the National Patriot, Diane Sorey from the Patriot Factor, getting you through the Tuesday night edition of the show, April 16th. Welcome to it. Hello, Diane.
Hello, Craig. And are you as tired as I am from the happenings of this weekend, staying on top of it all weekend long?
All day and all night.
Literally.
I mean, you know, look, folks, Friday during the show, we told you that an attack by Iran was imminent and would probably take place within about 24 hours, and it did.
Yes, it did. And let me tell you, you have got to give tremendous credit to Israel, the Iron Dome, our military, and especially surprisingly, while France and Great Britain took some part in it, Saudi Arabia, an Arab country, did as well. Together, they took down 99% of Iran's incoming drones and missiles.
Yeah, we're going to get to that here in just a minute. Let me tell folks what we've got coming up in the segments, the big segments of the show tonight. Diane, you're covering the conduit between war and peace.
Yes.
I'm going to be talking about the cold, hard truth of war.
You mean there's no lies in war?
Oh, I'm not saying that, but I am saying there is a cold, hard truth involved in war. And
that's true.
You know, there's a lot of people that have kind of forgotten about that, so I'm going to try and remind them of that. Saturday, late afternoon, mid-afternoon, when this all started, you know, with Israel, little Right Side Patriots behind the scenes here, but Diane and I were calling each other and shooting messages back and forth to each other because, you know, we were watching what was going on. We were getting information from sources and contacts and that did not let up Saturday night or Sunday.
No, in fact, it went into Monday and Tuesday, to be honest.
You know, we're still watching every last detail, yes, of what's going on here, because next week you and I are both doing articles. You're doing an op-ed, I'm doing a commentary regarding some of the stuff that we have learned since Saturday.
Yeah, and the thing is, because the story is constantly changing, we cannot lock in our articles for publication until the very last minute.
It's so fluid right now.
Yes.
Information is still coming in. We're learning more things. And one of the things, honestly, that we learned last night leading into this morning was the fact that, indeed, Saudi Arabia helped defend Israel Saturday night.
Yeah, they freely admitted it. They have put it up all over on X and different social media sites. And they stood by the Abraham Accords, which they agreed to. But what's unknown to most people is that Israel and Saudi Arabia have had a relationship for quite a bit of time now.
Yeah, it's been kind of off the books and maybe a little, yes, bit behind the scenes.
Yes.
Under the radar, so to speak. But they have. Now, has Saudi Arabia actually signed on to the Abraham Accords? I didn't think they had officially signed on to that.
I don't think they actually did, but I think what was going to happen before all this started on October 6th, they were ready to actually announce the normalization of relations with Israel.
Now, and then to be fair,
October 6th came and everything, you know, was fast and furious and nobody knew which way to go. But the relationship was existing behind the scenes.
To be fair and to be honest, Saudi Arabia has a long way to go when it comes to human rights. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they are making strides, and this particular stride is a big one.
Very big.
It would be one thing for Saudi Arabia to allow overflight for allies and Israel in their airspace, but to take an active role in assisting in bringing down some of the drones and missiles that were fired at Israel, that is an enormous step. And even bigger, I think, than that step is Saudi Arabia coming out and publicly declaring that they did it.
Exactly. And freely and happily doing it. This shows that certain countries, yes, they have far ways to go. But you want to know something? Yes, they have far ways to go with certain, it's more women's rights than human rights per se. Certain parts of Saudi Arabia are very, very westernized. Other parts are not. And they know they have a long way to go. But they now have a new leadership in this younger prince who's very open to Western ideas. And that's a big plus for Saudi Arabia. The one who really should be ashamed of themselves is Jordan.
You know, there were early reports, Diane, that Jordan had assisted in this. And you and I were talking about it on Saturday night, and it just seemed really odd to us. And we speculated that, well, maybe they allowed some defensive things to go on. But, you know, the idea that they actively participated in it seemed odd to us. And then we found out they didn't actually participate.
They did not participate at all. The drones and missiles that were shot down over Jordan, that was thanks to the American forces. Now, in my article for next week, I will have the link of the proof of that. You just have to, it's going to be in the link, and it's also going to be in the footnotes. You can access it from either thing. It was gotten from a contact of both Craig's and mine who knows this situation very, very well.
Well, and not
sent
only
the proof.
Not only U.S. Forces were operating there, but so were the French.
Right. Right. That's what I said in the beginning. The French and Great Britain also helped, but not to the degree that Saudi Arabia did.
Right. And that's that. Like I said, that's a huge step forward, and admitting to it willfully and proudly is yet another huge step forward. We were both wondering on Saturday night, what about Saudi Arabia? What about their airspace? You know, how are they handling this? And it took an extra couple of days to find out for sure. But when we found out, we were like, holy cow, really?
Yes. And another thing about Jordan, which kind of sealed the truth for Craig and I, is today Jordan announced that they will take no part in any attack on Iran. And there's reasons for that, because Iran already has operatives inside of Jordan.
Iran, you know, they've got tentacles that are all over the place.
right,
you know, in the region. And that's one of the things that made what happened Saturday and Saturday night so odd, is usually they let their proxies do their dirty work for them.
Yes.
And the proxies were involved. I mean, don't get me wrong. They were. We know the Houthis were involved, and we know Hezbollah was involved.
Mm-hmm.
But for Iran to take the extraordinary step of personal operation in this matter was very odd. But you know, like you say, they got their tentacles everywhere, including in Jordan. And, you know, we know the that Jordan and the Muslim Brotherhood are thick as thieves. We know that Iran has their tentacles in there. We know that Iran is supplying the Palestinians, use your air quotes, you know, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And normally the Iranians and the Muslim Brotherhood don't get along, but they're helping to supply the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza through secondary sources, you know.
Right. And let's make something clear also. When we say tentacles into Jordan, this is not something the Jordanian people want.
No.
This is something that Abdullah, the kinglet, as he was previously called now, the members of the Jordanian opposition coalition and the people have started referring to him as Ali Baba.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's kind of fitting. I mean, when you think about it, when you know his history as we do, it's really is kind of fitting. You know, Ali Baba, the kinglet, the king of Jordan, whatever you want to call him, he is most interested in cozying up and snuggling with whoever he thinks can provide him with power in the region.
Yes.
You know, that's his thing.
Right. He wants to be recognized as a big Arab leader.
Yeah, a player.
In the meantime, I don't know if any of you have ever really seen him, but he's a short, he's not an imposing figure by any means.
Kind of a rook.
And he's just, he's the antithesis of basically what his father was.
You know, his father was a leader, a statesman. He had charisma. You know, I mean, he was what you would think a leader would be. The kinglet is just kind of a sawed-off little runt who pretends to be a tough guy.
Right, with the Napoleon complex.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, really.
Yeah, and also, if you remember about King Hussein, he actually was the one that said the Palestinians have a homeland. It's called Jordan.
Right.
Jordan and the Palestinians are one and the same. So he's greatly different from his son.
You know, years ago, there was a big car rally that was taking place, and it came through Arizona. And my wife and I were living at the Grand Canyon at the time. And all of these, like, supercars were coming through the canyon, you know, coming through the South Rim and doing the South Rim drive and everything. And the kinglet was in one of them.
Okay.
I looked at that car, and I think it was a Bentley, and I looked at it, and I thought, that looks like that little guy from Jordan. It was. you know, it's like, well... And people think, well, now, how could that possibly be? You know, he owns property in the U.S. He owns a potato farm in Idaho, of all things.
And a home in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not, you know, and especially back then, because, I mean, this was 10, 11, 12 years ago. It would not have been out of the ordinary. Of course, he had people with him. He wasn't on his own. But it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to just see him in a situation like that. And there he was.
Right. It's a very convoluted situation over in the Middle East. But what these people don't understand is Israel is not going away.
No.
Saudi Arabia understands that. Egypt understands that. The main players understand it. It's all these little subgroups, the Syria, the Jordan, the Iraq, these countries, they don't understand that Israel, in a heartbeat, could wipe them off the map.
Well, everybody's always yelling about, you know, Israel needs to show restraint. Well, they've done that since 1947.
Exactly.
They're done with it now.
Mm-hmm.
I can't blame them.
No, I can't blame them either. October 6th was the game changer. And I just wish, and it's going to be part of my piece for next week, but I just wish that the hostages' families would stop their anti-Netanyahu rhetoric right now, if you will.
Right.
He is doing the best he can to save a nation, to save the entirety of the people. He's not responsible for what happened to the hostages. He is trying his best and has tried his best to get them out. But there comes a time when the families need to understand that the reason all the talks of ceasefire failed is because there are no more hostages.
Yeah.
Hamas, in our opinion, has killed them. Will there be one or two? Maybe by some sheer chance, but the majority of them are no longer alive, or we would have seen a ceasefire. You can't keep blaming Netanyahu. They have tried. They scour every place they go into looking for hostages. Last week, they found a few bodies and brought the bodies home.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sad situation over there for the families of these hostages. My guess personally is whoever's left that was being held hostage, they're probably members of the IDF. I think most of the civilians, if not all the civilians that were taken hostage back in October, most likely are gone.
Right. Right. And our heart breaks for them and for their families. But this is not Israel's fault. This is not Netanyahu's fault. The people that they should be angry at is Hamas.
Exactly. Okay, so in other news that we need to cover in this opening segment, today was day two of Trump's hush money trial in New York, and the situation with that gets more bizarre by the day.
That whole thing is a farce.
Really,
there's
is
no other way to say it. It is a complete and total farce. They are having trouble sitting a jury. Yesterday, I think a great majority of them said they could not be impartial towards Trump.
Right.
Well, they have no business being on a jury. Today, I believe they picked a few.
They've got six.
Six, that's what I thought. But you're talking about New York here, folks. And I can guarantee you, while the others say they can't be impartial, I have a sneaky feeling that the six have already made up a decision.
Well,
and not in Trump's favor.
They need 12 to actually sit on the jury, and they need six alternates.
Right.
They're saying, yeah, they're saying the picking the jury process could take maybe 10 days.
Ridiculous. But you know what got me angry? When the judge said that Trump must be present every single day. And President Trump said he has his son's graduation from high school. Can he be please be excused for that day? The judge has not made his decision about that.
No, and the judge kind of hemmed and hawed around about it. It kind of leads you to believe that he doesn't want to allow that. Here's something else the judge is not allowing. He's not allowing any practicing Jews, and I bring this up because on Trump's legal team are some practicing Jews. He's not going to allow practicing Jews any time off to observe Passover.
Well,
he said that.
Yeah, I know, but that's kind of too far. That's kind of shaky for two reasons. First, Passover, yes, the Orthodox go to synagogues in the morning, but the main part of Passover is the meals, not in the sense of the food, but Passover is about, you know, the eating of the unleavened bread, the matzahs.
Right.
It's more symbolic in the dinners, per se. And that always starts after sundown. Court usually ends about 4. But he's still wrong, because if there are any real observant Jews, they very well do go to temple on those days.
And that's the issue. That's what I said. There are some observant Jews on Trump's legal team, and they're not going to be allowed out of the courtroom to go to temple. That's wrong.
Well, not only is that wrong, but I believe that's illegal.
Do you think this judge cares if it's illegal?
No, but the lawyers might, and they might very well bring suit right there.
Well, they could, and they may well, but that's not going to delay anything, and they're not going to get that heard before Passover begins. So
Passover starts, I think it's over this weekend.
Yeah. So, I mean, look. Here's another thing, aside from all of that, okay? This is yet another crime, use your air quotes, that Trump has been charged with that has no harm done.
Well, okay? This is the hush money trial. Remember the Stormy Daniels and all that.
Oh, I know damn well what it is.
And she'll claim harm done to her.
Yeah, well, it's a little late for that. And I'll tell you why. Okay? I'm going to read you something. This is from Stormy Daniels. This has been signed by Stormy Daniels. This comes from January 30th, 2018.
Okay.
To whom it may concern. Over the past few weeks, I have been asked countless times to comment on reports of an alleged sexual relationship I had with Donald Trump many, many, many years ago. The fact of the matter is that each party to this alleged affair denied its existence in 2006, 2011, 2016, 2017, and now again in 2018. I am not denying this affair because I was paid hush money, as has been reported in overseas-owned tabloids. I am denying this affair because it never happened. I will have no further
thrown out immediately.
I will have no further comment on this matter. Please feel free to check me out on Instagram at the Stormy Daniels, and then it's signed, thank you, Stormy Daniels.
Then why are they even holding this trial? This should be grounds for immediate dismissal of all charges.
I'll tell you why. Okay, for the same reason, they fined Donald Trump 400 and some odd million and then reduced it down to 175 million for harm that was never done. Those bankers came in that trial and said, no, we didn't lose any money. In fact, we want to do more business with him.
Right. Right.
Again, this is a crime where no harm was done to anybody. Stormy Daniels herself has said this over and over in public. It never happened. She was never paid hush money. The affair never happened. In one instance, she actually said in an interview that when she met Donald Trump, he was nothing but a gentleman, polite and courteous to her and everybody with her.
Is she going to be called as a witness?
Well, yes.
Then they, by all means, if she stood up there and read that letter, and she dared to contradict it now, she would be in trouble. And the fact that she did write the letter, technically, to me, should mean this should be immediately thrown out.
Right. The letter itself exonerates Trump completely.
Right.
Yet the prosecution's main witness, of course, is Michael Cohen.
Oh, well, yeah.
Okay, he's been found guilty of perjury. He's a congenital liar.
Right.
And, you know, he's their star witness to any of this. I mean, what this case is, or what it started out to be, was a bookkeeping error.
Right.
Okay. Alvin Bragg, the DA in Manhattan, he has wrangled this thing into a felony from a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
It can only be classified as a felony if the misdemeanor was done in the effort to cover up another crime. According to Alan Bragg, another crime existed, but he will not say what the other crime is.
Hmm. Well, what this is just another number in the long list of witch hunt numbers?
Absolutely.
That's all it is.
I mean, it's crazy. All right, folks. Well, of course, we'll keep an eye on that. We may have more news regarding that coming up on Friday here on the show. So we'll keep an eye on that because, you know, there's going to be more shenanigans. Also, the judge kind of got on Trump's case today because he said something during court. And of course, he's under a gag order, and Alvin Bragg, the DA, is trying to get him thrown into jail for contempt.
Alvin Bragg has a vendetta going, and if people can't see that, they really are blind. This man is laser focused on destroying Donald Trump.
Yep.
There is something seriously wrong with Alan Bragg.
Seriously. Folks, we got to take a break. We're down here to the bottom of the hour. 30 minutes from now, I'm talking about the cold, hard truth of war. But when we come back from this bottom of the hour break, Diane has it with the conduit between war and peace. Stay with us. There's more Right Side Patriots after that.
You're listening to Right Side Patriots Radio, the best in conservative commentary, news, and talk, where we do away with the politically correct nonsense and give you the politically direct truth. This is the home of Right Side Patriots every Tuesday and Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern with Craig Andreessen and Diane Sorey. We're working to make this country great again from the right and leaving puddles of melted snowflakes on the left. Thanks for listening to Right Side Patriots, your best bet on the internet.
You're listening to RSPRadio1.com.
Hi guys, Diane Sori from The Patriot Factor on thepatriotfactor.blogspot.com, where I found a home base 7 years ago after becoming one of Facebook's long-time Facebook felons, or so I've been told by the Facebook gods. On my blog, you will find not only my articles, but our Right Side Patriots investigative reports, as well as stories and links to and from well-known writers and bloggers, plus what I call almost daily memes, my snarky take on news of the day. And for more great takes on the issues of the day, check out The National Patriot at thenationalpatriot.com, where you can read Craig's insight into all the current news happenings. And join us both on Right Side Patriots every Tuesday and Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. EST at RSPRadio1.com.
Welcome back to Right Side Patriots on RSPRadio1.com. Craig Andreessen at the National Patriot, Diane Sori at the Patriot Factor. It's Tuesday night, and if you miss any part of the show, go to RSPRadio1.com tomorrow morning, click the podcast button, and have at it.
Yes.
All right. Tonight, in our respective segments, we are both taking on aspects of the war that's going on between Israel and Hamas, different aspects of it. Next week, we're both dealing with parts of what took place on Saturday and Saturday night with Iran and Israel. But these are not a part one, part two thing, either one of them, this week or next week. These are complementary pieces. And Diane, you looked at the situation like we always do, from stepping back and looking at the big picture. And you came up with an op-ed, The Conduit Between War and Peace.
Yes. And let's start with this quote. It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true. They could have risen up. They could have fought against that evil regime. That was said by Israeli President Isaac Herzog when he was asked by reporters why no Palestinians have fought back or outwardly condemned Hamas. So now, as the Israeli-Hamas war shows little sign of abating anytime soon, we see some in the misguided court of public opinion trying to portray Israel's continuing response to the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas as now having been in overkill mode. But nothing could be further from the truth, for Israel has exposed for all to see, that is, if one does indeed seek truth, just how little Hamas cares even about their own fellow Palestinians. Hiding rockets, bombs, arms, and munitions in schools and hospitals, which Hamas knows are in areas teeming with civilians, also means that Hamas also knows that collateral damage is sure to come, and on a grand scale, as even they know that Israel has every right to target for reprisals areas and buildings from where said weapons were launched. But Hamas doesn't care. And why would they? As they are willingly using both Palestinian civilians and Israeli hostages as disposable human shields. Actually, what these actions of Hamas has shown to the world is that they are abject cowards of the very worst kind. And the word coward itself should be but an acronym for Hamas, for only cowards prey upon those they know cannot defend themselves. And even with Hamas publicly garnering tears over Palestinian lives lost, again lives they actually care nothing about, one can see that their final goal remains but a replay of Hitler's final solution. And they care less that history itself has shown that war is a not ever problem solution.
The only true solution remains in securing a lasting peace. But if lasting peace is ever to be achieved between Israel and the entirety of its Arab neighbors, peace that goes beyond just the on-paper recognizing of Israel's right to exist, all sides must be willing to have not only an open-ended and civilized dialogue, but, Craig, they also need an exchange of ideas, which includes having the willingness to compromise, at least to some degree, in the name of peace, if need be.
Well, compromise, that's an interesting term, especially in this situation, because every time compromised is mentioned in the Middle East, Israel is the one that has to compromise.
Right.
You know, what do you see as the path toward peace?
Well, first of all, I need to say that extremism and terrorism both have shown not to have any place in compromise. In fact, both are the antithesis thereof, with but one exception now being that the Hamas-initiated war with Israel must immediately come to an end via Hamas issuing what is a full and unconditional surrender. For in their not doing so, they, not Israel, are the root cause of even more innocent Palestinian lives being lost. Why so? Because only when Hamas surrenders will the Israeli bombing stop. Only when Hamas surrenders will humanitarian aid be able to freely enter Gaza. And only when Hamas surrenders will the Palestinian people be able to even start thinking about a future, minus all the conflict and hate their leaders and their loyalists have created. Remember, it's self-serving political leaders and dictators, the hallmark of what has now become known as geopolitical actors, that benefit personally from war, whether said war be either an internal or external conflict. And the wars they fight are for self-glorification and for the condensing of power, which in turn expands and thus solidifies their control over the masses. And the biggest losers in war remains as it has always been, as in the innocent victims, collateral damage, as they are sometimes referred to, who have no means by which to fight back. Sway the masses to your side, keep them in line with iron fist policies that allow for no deviation, and those few who do dissent become voices not heard nor cared about. Now, this is a quote. There is no difference between Hamas and Palestinian people, end quote. That was said by Musab Hassan Youssef, the Israel-supporting and now disowned son of Hamas's very co-founder, Sheikha Hassan Youssef. Now, when Hamas, who began as a spinoff of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and who believes the killing of Jews to be a rightful holy war, took control of the Gaza Strip after their 2006 election defeat of their political rival Fatah, any semblance of sanity that somehow and somewhat more moderate PLO had to offer the Palestinians was thrown by the wayside. And the Palestinians in Gaza knew well that those they were casting their vote for were but a terrorist gang of thugs, thieves, and hoodlums who relished in serving themselves at the expense and needs of the people. And Craig, the people also knew that Hamas was serving as the area's Iranian proxy, a proxy whose goal was and remains the total elimination of the Jewish state of Israel.
You know, that quote that you had by Youssef, that came in a television show, and you've got the video of that, of him saying that to a couple of pro-Palestinians on that show.
Yeah, and I also have a video embedded in here of some of the weapons that the Israeli IDF found when they entered those hospitals.
You know, like rats off a sinking ship, Hamas is trying desperately to get out of Gaza. Where are they trying to get into at this point?
Right. Well, let's say, you know, Hamas really is treading on its last legs thanks to Israel's fighting back. Why else would Iran now be moving forces into neighboring Syria? But to expand a war, even the mullahs must know they cannot win. And their excuse being, with no tangible proof to back it up, that a recent missile strike that they believe came from Israel hit their consulate in Damascus and killed a senior Revolutionary Guard Corps commander. But more likely, I'd say, this was a disposable individual now willingly giving up his life to become a martyr for the cause being Israel's ultimate destruction. And as Joe Biden keeps twisting the knife deeper into Israel's back by his calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and the Hamas terrorists, the fact remains that the Israeli-Hamas war will continue on until in the end there will either be peace or the war will grow until one side is forced to annihilate the other. Better now for all concerned that a permanent solution be found, a solution acceptable to all parties, but it must be a solution that includes a now and forever abandonment of all calls for Islamic jihad against the Jewish state of Israel. But really, are there any tangible and workable solutions to this war, or will this war eventually die down on its own accord, only to be reignited at some future date? I believe there is a path forward to peace, but that only one solution is feasible, whether some like it or not, and that is creating a Palestinian state, which, when created, will in and of itself help in the diffusing of a certain modicum of hate. However, said solution does come with one key caveat, one not now or ever open to discussion. As said, creation must never, I repeat, never involve Israel giving up any more of its land for the building of such state. Israel has already given up land, as in the West Bank, and all it's done is seeing the Palestinians wanting more, even more, of Israel's land. Simply, the only way this solution can work, is if any of the 22 Arab nations that comprise the 5,148,014 square miles of the Arab world are willing to give up a sliver of their land for the creation of a Palestinian state with, and this is critical, said state created must not lie on Israel's border and must not be governed by any terrorist supporting or condoning groups. Remember, with Israel being but 8,630 square miles in size, which roughly equates to the size of New Jersey, the combined Arab lands roughly equates to 500 times the size of Israel. And Craig, logic alone should then dictate that the land for a Palestinian state should rightfully come from the Palestinians' fellow brethren's. It is, after all, time for them to take care of their own, with no land being taken from Israel, nor should the UN or the US be the ones to decide both the fate of the sovereign nation of Israel, nor how Israel fights its wars.
Well, you know, geographically, Israel is a grain of sand in a giant desert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And you're right, there's no reason why the quote-unquote Palestinians have to live within that one grain of sand or even next to it.
Right.
But let me ask you this. How viable is a two-state solution at this point?
Okay. Well, this means that what some call a two-state solution solely within the boundaries of Israel is a permanent no-go, as is also an idea being floated that the Palestinians receive citizenship under either one state or a confederation of states, with Israel then being their overseers of sorts. But I say an equivocal no to this deal, for it's time those who call themselves Palestinians, or in some cases Gazans, learn to succeed or fail on their own accord, and let the consequences of their actions be carried by them alone. Now here one might ask, what about Jordan? For Jordan is already home to 1 in 5 of its citizens being of Palestinian descent. And while that seems on the surface to be an easy solution to the problem as to where the Palestinians belong, it is simply not. And why? Because Jordan's Hashemite King Abdullah is not now, nor ever was, the man he tries to pass himself off to be, as in a man more westernized in his thinkings and beliefs, but is instead a man who actually runs Jordan as a police state, and who was hell-bent on keeping these people out of Jordan for economic reasons, he so claims. But the truth is that with there being many different tribes who call themselves Palestinians, Abdullah cannot afford their collective numbers to outnumber those in Jordan of Hashemite descent, especially when the one thing uniting said tribes is a hatred of Israel and the Jewish people, which itself could stir up even more trouble than Abdullah is already facing. A possible powder keg within Jordan itself, the country lying directly on Israel's eastern border, would surely arise, coupled with the fact that Hamas not only sprang from the infamous Muslim Brotherhood, but that it is the Muslim Brotherhood who still remains deeply embedded within Jordan, and who, with both Abdullah's permission and assistance, remains a key player not only in Jordan's politics, but in their pushing forward the rhetoric of Israel hatred. And Craig, this alone assures that Jordan is not now nor likely to be a feasible option in regards to peace anytime soon. That is, unless King Abdullah himself was removed from power by the Jordanian people alone. But that still leaves 21 other Arab nations who very well might be a conduit for a lasting Middle East peace.
Well, I guess at this point, it's really not about any individual country being accepting of the Palestinians, but it's more of the entire Arab conglomerate being, or at least having, an obligation, right?
Well, really, it's past time for the Palestinians, fellow Arabs, to collectively not only take care of, but take responsibility for the very people whose bloodline they share. This war must end with a lasting peace in place, a peace most especially favorable to Israel, while at the same time being fair to the Palestinians, who must not only break all ties to terrorist groups, but who, while it might sound a bit simplistic, must now start teaching their own children not to hate. The only other option seems to be that if peace is not reached anytime soon, if collateral damage alone is allowed to take over the entirety of the public discourse, then the Israeli-Hamas war will spread not just regionally, but globally. And this in turn will force Israel to do what Israel probably should have done when hearing of the first Israeli baby being cooked to death in a kibbutz oven by Hamas. Bitter thoughts, upsetting thoughts, yet thoughts we all need to think long and hard about, for the fact remains that without peace, it well could come to what, for now, thankfully, remains the unthinkable. May the light of everlasting peace help to extinguish the fires of hate. Case closed.
It's a very interesting op-ed. And there's, you know, it's like I said at the beginning of this segment, we always step back and look at the bigger picture. And that's what you've done with this op-ed. You have looked at the bigger picture. Instead of focusing on little individual peccadilloes, for lack of a better term, you have really focused on the bigger picture. What is the future of the region? And how can it be shaped for the best? You know, folks, before I go any further here, I just want to tell you, you can get Diane's op-ed either at her blog, thepatriotfactor.blogspot.com, or by going to rspradio1.com. Either way, you can get the link, and I hope you share it everywhere, if for no other reason than to watch those two videos that Diane has embedded in the blog. The one of the Dr. Phil show is, I think, earth-shaking. You know, when Masab Hazan Youssef, the son of the co-founder of Hamas, sits there on a national television show face-to-face with a couple of pro-Hamas activist women and tells them the things he tells them and the look on their face, they had never heard this, especially coming from somebody with that kind of a direct tie to the situation, somebody who actually knows firsthand, and even if you want to say it, genetically, what's going on over there, they were shocked. Shocked.
They were beyond shock. But I also want people to know that I mentioned the term Palestinian tribes. The Palestinians are not one solid people. They are a collective of different groups of Palestinians. And I have a footnote in the article where I list the main tribes. And none of those tribes are Hashemite. And that is really what Abdullah is afraid of. That is why he doesn't want them in his country.
Yeah, I mean, A, they're troublemakers, and everybody in the Arab world knows it. And a big reason for that is the tribal factions that exist amongst the quote-unquote Palestinian people. And in Abdullah's case, there's way more of them being non-Hashemites, than there are of him being Hashemite.
Right.
And he looks, you know, it's like I said earlier in the show. He's this guy that wants to be seen as a player in the region, and he's going to cozy up and spoon with whoever he thinks is going to allow him some power. Right. If the non-Hashemites move in and throw him out, he's got nothing.
Right. We're talking about 2 million displaced Palestinians right now. Technically, they have blood ties to Jordan. Logically, they should go back to Jordan, but he can't allow that.
No, not if he wants to keep power, and that's what he wants more than anything else. Now, you know, I understand, you know, when you say there's 2 million displaced Palestinians, right? In a region like that, that's a lot. To suddenly flood into anywhere, that's a lot.
Well, that's why, you know, it's not that giving them their own homeland is something they deserve. They already technically have Jordan.
Right.
And, you know, if the king was ever thrown out and the Jordanian opposition coalition moved in, they would be welcomed back to Jordan. We don't know when and if that would happen. So you have to look at the big picture and say, well, let's give them a homeland. But it's not in Israel. It's not near Israel's border. And it's not going to be run by a terrorist organization. We've got 21 other Arab countries, big, giant, countries. I read the numbers and the difference in size.
Listen, not only did you read the numbers, but I want to point this out too. In your blog, you have a map, an illustration of a map that shows, and I mean, if you magnify it, you can find Israel on that map. But the rest
Israel
of it
is the little squiggle in red, and the entirety of the Arab world is in green.
Yeah. You need to see that map, folks, so you understand what Diana's talking about. Numbers are numbers, but when you see it visually, you kind of look at it and go, holy crap.
Yeah. A Palestinian state, like I said, nowhere near Israel, no Israeli land, no terrorist organizations in charge. It's time their own brethren welcome them back. But the problem is, wherever the Palestinians, this group goes, there's trouble, there's terrorism, there's corruption. Nobody wants these people. And that's because they have done nothing to help themselves.
Not only have they done nothing to help themselves, and you're absolutely correct on that, they haven't done anything that helps the region. They haven't done anything that helps other Arab nations. They haven't done, they don't work and play well with others.
No. And they're so, and their children, I hate to say this, but this generation, the generation that's now living in Gaza, their children have been indoctrinated since a very, very young age to hate Jews and hate Israel. Hate to such a degree that the textbooks that Palestinian children use in school show no mention of Israel. Where Israel is and parts of Egypt and Jordan, that has now been called Palestine.
Right.
This is indoctrination that if we don't watch ourselves here in these liberal, you know, universities and such, this kind of indoctrination is starting to spread. And this is dangerous in its own right.
Well, absolutely. It's destabilizing.
Very. Look what's happening here, folks.
Hey, look at San Francisco over the weekend, the Golden Gate Bridge. You had the pro-Hamas faction out there trying to shut it down. You've got pro-Hamas factions on all these college campuses, even in the Ivy League.
Yeah. Okay,
you got pro-Hamas in the halls of Congress.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know,
they tried to shut down the Senate dining room.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like political chlamydia. Once it gets started, you can't stop it.
I just thought of something. They were protesting in the Senate, dining room and such. Who let them in?
Well, I give you three guesses, and the first two don't count.
Oh, yeah. I know who probably let them in. But you can't just walk into the United States Senate. There's sign-ins and a couple of other things before you can enter there.
You know, it was only a few years ago that such an incursion was called an insurrection.
That's true. Why isn't this being called an insurrection?
Well, the sandals on the other foot.
Yeah. And it's smelly and stinky.
it really is. Folks, go to Diane's blog, thepatriotfactor.blogspot.com, or go to rspradio1.com. Either way, you can get the link to Diane's op-ed, The Conduit Between War and Peace. And we hope you spread it everywhere. With that, we've hit the top of the hour. That means we have to take another quick break. But when we come back, final segment of the show tonight, I'm talking about the cold, hard truth of war. Stay with us. There's more Right Side Patriots after this.
Hi, guys. Diane Sori from The Patriot Factor on thepatriotfactor.blogspot.com, where I found a home base 7 years ago after becoming one of Facebook's longtime Facebook felons, or so I've been told by the Facebook gods. On my blog, you will find not only my articles, but our Right Side Patriots investigative reports, as well as stories and links to and from well-known writers and bloggers, plus what I call almost daily memes, my snarky take on news of the day. And for more great takes on the issues of the day, check out the National Patriot at thenationalpatriot.com, where you can read Craig's insight into all the current news happenings. And join us both on Right Side Patriots every Tuesday and Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. EST at rspradio1.com.
You're listening to Right Side Patriots Radio, the best in conservative commentary, news, and talk, where we do away with the politically correct nonsense and give you the politically direct truth. This is the home of Right Side Patriots every Tuesday and Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern with Craig Andreessen and Diane Sori. We're working to make this country great again from the right and leaving puddles of melted snowflakes on the left. Thanks for listening to Right Side Patriots, your best bet on the internet.
You're listening to RSPRadio1.com.
Welcome back to Right Side Patriots on RSPRadio1.com. Craig Andreessen at The National Patriot, Diane Sori at The Patriot Factor. If you miss any part of tonight's show, go to rspradio1.com tomorrow morning, click the podcast button. This show in its entirety and all the rest will be right there waiting for you.
Yes, it will be.
All right, so we're both taking a look at different aspects of the war that's going on between Israel and Hamas tonight. We're going to be doing this again with the situation with Iran next week, okay?
Right. And Craig, people should know that both of our articles were written before this past weekend.
That's true, yeah. So I looked at a situation that transpired over there in this war a week and a half ago, and I thought, you know, there's a lot of bellyaching going on about this thing, and it's all by people who don't understand the cold, hard truth of war. Now, while I'm sure that there will be some who believe my take on what happened a week ago during the war against Hamas is completely insensitive, I assure you that it is 100% rooted in reality. A week ago, the IDF, in what Israel said was a grave mistake, targeted three vehicles which they believed to have been occupied by Hamas gunmen. The three vehicles were destroyed, but rather than containing Hamas fighters, those vehicles were occupied by members of the World Central Kitchen, the WCK, occupied by seven aid workers, all of whom were killed in the strike. One IDF colonel and one IDF major were dismissed from service. Three IDF commanders have been formally reprimanded, and the drone unit responsible for carrying out the strike has been suspended after a report compiled by, quote, professional independent body that is outside the chain of command, unquote. Those are huge steps taken in the wake of a grave mistake, and the fact that Israel quickly admitted to the mistake and took such steps is no small thing in the Middle East in the middle of a war. But the international pressure against Israel continues to mount, by what are mostly pro-Hamas factions in foreign governments, international organizations, and of course from the Biden regime. Diane, none of those pro-Hamas entities are bothering to mention the elephant in the room, so I guess I'll have to.
I guess you will. But before you mention that, let me say something about this. Those people that were let go, reprimanded, etc., I don't believe they should have been, because these people were in a war zone, a known war zone. And when you're, you know, in a war zone, there's always the chance of you becoming collateral damage. If you don't want collateral damage, don't go to war.
Look, I understand there are some people in the world who find a noble calling to help others regardless of politics. And I'll be honest, I don't know the politics of the seven aid workers who were killed in that strike. But for the sake of argument, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that all seven were there out of the kindness of their hearts. The WCK seems to be a solid charity and relief organization founded by Chef Jose Andres. And the WCK's website says, quote, WCK is first to the front lines, providing fresh meals in response to humanitarian, climate, and community crises, unquote. That website then goes on to tell of the WCK setting up in places devastated by disasters like Haiti after the earthquake, Houston after Hurricane Harvey, even in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. The WCK assisted people after hurricanes, earthquakes, wildfires, and even volcanic eruptions, all good causes without regard to politics. But something changed, and the WCK started wading into political situations. They started providing meals to those trying to enter the U.S. illegally and inserted themselves into Ukraine after the Russia invasion. Now, they've plopped themselves into Gaza in the middle of a war zone. Were there communities in Israel that were devastated in the days and weeks after the October 7th barbaric attack by Hamas? Of course there were. Did the WCK show up in any of those communities to assist the Israeli people? There seems to be no evidence that they did, but they insert themselves in Gaza to help the people who support Hamas, the barbarians who perpetrated the October 7th massacre? Let's get something straight here. The Palestinian people are not victims of some natural disaster, nor are they victims of some sort of humanitarian crisis. They are the victims of their own ideology. The vast majority of Palestinian people chose Hamas as their government and have, for the better part of 20 years, supported every Hamas strike against Israel. They have supported Hamas using hospitals, schools, and neighborhoods as bases for their weapons, military headquarters, and from which rockets have been fired into Israel. Diane, the Palestinian people have, time and time again, supported Hamas every time Hamas has broken a ceasefire, and they cheered when Hamas barbarians committed atrocities against Israel on October 7th, 2023.
And this is why the son of Hamas's founders said what he said, that the Palestinians and Hamas are one and the same. There is no difference. The people in Gaza, over these years since they took over, have done nothing to get rid of them, even knowing that they were stealing aid that was coming to them, the people. They were living well and wealthy and happily fed, while the Palestinian people in Gaza really had a hard time of it, but they did nothing to remedy it.
That's very true. look, the war that continues there today is a war Hamas, with the support of the majority of the Palestinian people, started, and the devastation wreaked upon them is exactly what they invited, one time too many. So why Gaza? Why the Palestinian people? Well, once again, we go to the WCK website, and there we find, quote, WCK believes that feeding people in need is a fundamental act of compassion and solidarity. Our teams are on the ground in Gaza, working tirelessly to provide nourishing meals to Palestinians who have been forced to flee their homes. From our relief kitchen in Rafah to our dedicated team of volunteers and partners, we've already served more than 30 million meals. The website goes on to state, and again I quote, in Ramadan, the values of compassion, generosity, and sympathy are amplified. It's a time for reflection, gratitude, and above all, a time to prioritize the well-being of others. At WCK, we understand the importance of embodying these values through our actions. During Ramadan and beyond, we're committed to being on the ground feeding the people in need, unquote. Ramadan, the period of fasting, and the WCK has served up more than 30 million meals. Here are the rules for fasting during Ramadan, and I quote, fasting Muslims eat a pre-dawn meal called suhoor and a post-sundown meal called iftar. For iftar, dates and water or milk are often consumed before the dinner itself. Everyone is also allowed to snack and hydrate between dusk and dawn. At sunrise, the fasting day begins again. Only healthy adults are required to fast during Ramadan. Children, the elderly, those mentally or physically incapable of fasting, pregnant or breastfeeding women, and travelers are not expected to fast, unquote. Basically, aside from breakfast, snacks throughout the day, appetizers, and dinner, Muslims are fasting during Ramadan, unless we're talking about kids, old people, pregnant women, breastfeeding women, the mentally ill, or anybody who might be hungry. Let me be perfectly honest. The Palestinian people are fleeing their homes as a result of a war they started. And what the WCK conveniently omits from their website regarding Ramadan is this, quote, Palestinian Islamic Jihad is calling for Ramadan to be a month of terror and seeks to escalate attacks in the West Bank and Gaza, unquote. Diane, to be fair, Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad are two different entities, but they are hardly separate entities. As PIJ receives support from Iran, Syria, and Lebanese Hezbollah, and they have a marriage of convenience with Hamas in the war against Israel.
Basically, what WCK has become is enablers. They are enabling the terrorists to continue their fight. What they are bringing, or what they did bring into Gaza during Ramadan, because Ramadan is over, is a joke. These people, from what you just read, eat more during the day than I do.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. Than most people do. This is not fasting. Fasting means nothing. Period. Nothing. No snacks. No pre-snacks before a big dinner. You know, if you can't go a whole day without eating, you're not fasting.
I agree.
It's a joke.
It is a joke. So what that tells us is that the WCK has inserted themselves under the guise of being a humanitarian organization into the war in Gaza to assist the very people, the majority of whom elected and support an international terrorist organization hell-bent on wiping Israel and the Jewish people from the face of the earth. But not only that, WCK has inserted themselves and their aid workers into the middle of a war zone in what I believe is nothing more than a virtue signaling effort to garner international acclaim from those who support and back Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, Syria, and Islamic Jihad, while trying to portray themselves as do-gooders with hearts of gold. Here's the deal. When you invite one of the most powerful militaries on the planet to go to war against you, you should not be one bit surprised when things get messy. When you elect a barbaric terrorist organization to lead you and allow them to set up military shop in your neighborhoods, in your hospitals and schools, and when you allow the barbarians to blend into your daily lives, you should not be one bit surprised when the powerful military you invited to go to war against you turns your neighborhoods, your schools, your hospitals, and your towns into rubble-filled gravel pits. When you allow the barbarians to blend in to look like you and pretend to be ordinary people, don't be surprised or act shocked when civilians get killed in the war zone. Any military with orders to win the war are going to kill people on purpose, and sometimes by accident. The IDF is not a bunch of social workers. They're not show ponies, and they're not there to play pity pat and patty cake. The IDF is one of the world's foremost fighting forces whose job it is to kill people and break things in defense of their nation and in defense of their people. The WCK had no business sending a bunch of chefs, line cooks, waiters, and waitresses into the middle of a hot war with the expectation that only good things would happen. The seven that got killed in what Israel admits was a grave mistake were not trained militarily. They were trained to make sandwiches, kebabs, frika, hummus, and other regional favorites. While it's a shame that seven people, who may well have been clueless as to the intent of the organization they were a part of, it's pretty hard for me to give a boo-hoo about people with no understanding of the situation they willingly walked into, thinking that they were somehow immune to bad things happening in the middle of a war zone. Diane, I suspect that neither the organization, WCK, or the cooks that willingly went into that war zone were bright enough to understand that the only reason they were being tolerated by the barbarians of Hamas and the people that support Hamas is because they were cooking and serving more than 30 million meals during their time of fasting, or that they had been there at any other point in time other than during a hot war, they, as outsiders, would have become the targets themselves.
Well, what they kind of made themselves was the center of attention. Look at me, look at me, look at what we're doing, look how good we are. In a way, they were there for self-gratification.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. If not to support the ideology that started the war, then why enter the war zone? The only other reason would be for the press coverage by those sympathetic to Hamas. Virtue signaling at its worst. There are plenty of places and people in the world that could benefit from the WCK, but those places aren't on the front page. And if the virtue signaling requires a war zone, then go help people that didn't start the war. Go back to Ukraine and help the people there who did nothing to invite Russia to invade them. Israel has admitted they made a grave mistake. They have even taken immediate action against those from within their own ranks who were responsible for that grave mistake, and they have issued an apology. Beyond that, the WCK nor the families of those killed have anything coming to them other than being told that they should have known better than to virtue signal in the middle of a hot war. to the WCK and others without military experience who insert themselves in life-endangering situations and then demand action be taken on their behalf, make yourselves some comfort food and be more mindful of the cold, hard truth of war.
Yeah, you know, war is not a pretty thing, and it's time people realize that. These people that went in there, they knew what they were going into. They also knew that there was a risk going in there. They also knew that collateral damage is a part of war. It will always be a part of war. It's a sad part of war, but it's still there. And this organization, I think, was trying to make a statement, and I think they were trying to politicize which side they were on.
I think it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the situation that's going on over there, and you look at how that situation got started, I guarantee you there were kibbutzes and towns and communities in Israel that were devastated by what happened on October 7th. But we have absolutely no reason to believe the WCK ever lifted a finger or a frying pan to help them.
Right. Two or three kibbutzes were completely devastated.
You know, but yet there they go marching across the border into Gaza. And, yeah. And then they have the nerve to say, well, you can't shoot at us. We're cooks.
I'd like to know which way they got in. Did they come in through Egypt? Or did Israeli checkpoints let them in? I don't think we know.
I don't think we know for sure, but if I had to guess, they went in with humanitarian aid workers, so they probably went through the Rafah Gate, which is Egypt.
Egypt.
You know, because they're you know, they're under the guise of a humanitarian organization. Okay, I get that. And
do they have any connection to the UN?
Well, I don't know that they have a direct connection to the UN, but I know they rely on the UN to help get them in to different places at different times. You know, I mean, look, we're, you know, here's how you do it. We're a humanitarian organization. We cook meals for people in need. And we're here to provide humanitarian aid for the people who have been displaced from their homes inside Gaza. Okay, so you're standing there at the Rafah Gate, and you're telling people this, and you've got a website, and you have a history of being in places where people are in need. And, you know, they're going to vet them and they're going to see that. And they're going to, okay, you know. But it ultimately, it's their choice. Nobody forced them into that war zone.
Exactly.
Okay. And that's where I've got the problem. You know, their families, you know, oh, we have to have a ceasefire. You know, our family members got killed. Well, I feel almost as sorry for them as I do for those two idiots years and years and years ago who got killed because they decided to go hiking in Iran.
Yeah, I remember that. This is a case, pure and simple, of unfortunate collateral damage due to a mistake. Now, usually Israel does not make mistakes when they target a specific vehicle. I wonder if this vehicle somehow was not dressed, if you will, the way it should have been to clearly state it as a humanitarian truck.
Yeah, I don't know because the vehicles were destroyed, and I've got a photo of one of them. Actually, I got two photos of two of the three vehicles in there.
Yeah, you do.
You know?
Yeah.
And the fact that Israel said, okay, we made a grave mistake, and they took action immediately, relieving a couple of people, suspending a couple of people, and suspending the drone team, that tells you a lot about Israel. They didn't try to sweep it under the rug. Well, I don't know that they should have done that either, but at least they didn't try to sweep it under the rug.
Oh, right. Yeah, you know? That you got to give them credit.
You got to give them their due for that, right?
Yes.
You know, but to go into a hot war zone on behalf of the very people who perpetrated the attack that started the war, and then think you're somehow immune from bad things because you're a cook and you're making a souffle.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but if you go back, even in American history, there have been Army chefs, Navy chefs, and maybe even a couple of guys cooking grub for the Marines who were on, let's say, the wrong end of friendly fire because the food wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bad things are going to happen to you in a war zone. And if you're going to walk into a war zone, you got to be cognizant of that before you go in.
Well,
this is pretty
I'll tell
simple.
You, I'm more shocked about how much people eat during the Ramadan fast.
Well, and that's why I thought I had to put that in there, because they're talking on their website. WCK is talking on their website about feeding people during Ramadan. Ramadan is the period of fasting.
Right.
So I thought, okay, I'm going to go find out exactly what the rules are for Ramadan fasting. And what I found out, I put in the commentary.
So what are they missing? Word for word. What meal are they missing?
Lunch.
But they're having a snack between breakfast and what would be lunch, and it doesn't say the size of the snack, and then they're having another snack between what was lunch and dinner.
And dinner. And then for dinner, they start with appetizers and then have dinner.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, look, I can explain it to you, but I can't make you understand it. Okay, I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. I can explain it. I just can't help you understand it.
Because I don't think you understand it either.
Well, no, I mean, because it makes no sense, right? Fasting Muslims eat a pre-dawn meal called sahur and a post-sundown meal called iftar. For iftar, dates and water or milk are often consumed before the dinner itself. Everyone is allowed to snack and hydrate between dusk and dawn. At sunrise, the fasting day begins again. Okay. On the other hand, if you're a kid or an old person, if you're a pregnant woman, a breastfeeding woman, hungry or nuttier than a squirrel turd, you can just go ahead and eat all day.
You know what real fasting is? What the observant Jews do on Yom Kippur. After their dinner, their evening meal, they do not eat anything again until the next day's evening meal. That's fasting.
Yeah. I know that. You know that. Everybody with a working brain cell knows that. Okay. Folks, you can get my commentary this week, The Cold Hard Truth of War, by going to my blog, thenationalpatriot.com, or going to rspradio1.com. Either way, you can get the link, and I hope you share it everywhere. But with that, Diane, you and I are pretty much out of time for tonight's show.
Okay, and with that, we'll say nighty-night and see you on Friday.
Have yourselves a great rest of the week, folks. We'll catch up with you again on Friday. Bye-bye.